Let's pray. Almighty God, we bow before you. We are grateful for this evening. We are grateful for this amazing world in which you have placed us, in which you have given us life, and through Jesus Christ you have given us new life. We ask your help. We need your guidance to live this life every day. Guide us in what we do, in what we say, but also in how we think. And challenge us this evening in the ways we think, even as we seek your blessing on our denomination. Guide those who are in positions of authority or influence, and help us through our prayers to be part of that influence and that impact. In Christ's name. Amen. Do any of you remember what the title of tonight's talk is? Something like this. This is all, etc. Which is, you know, thank you for coming tonight. This is about half the size of last time, so you're the ones who are staying for all the rest. Oops, let me spell that correctly. So let me begin looking at all the rest. We're looking at the General Assembly, what's coming up at the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church at the end of June and the beginning of July. It's going to be in Pittsburgh, up the road in Pittsburgh. And I want to begin not by reviewing everything that's happening there, but actually by taking us back to last time, and then we'll get into what's going on. I know even as I go back to last time, you may have some questions. You may not have been here last time, and you say, wait a minute, you're covering that too quickly. Well, the answer is yes, I am covering it too quickly, but that's what we're going to do, and we'll see if we've got some time at the end. So last time we looked at my view, and I think it's the biblical view. Somebody else might say, it's your biblical view. And the confessional view, that is through the lens of the confessions of the Presbyterian Church view of sexuality, did so in the context of our present world. So I shared a lot about the sexual chaos we see in the world around about us here in all kinds of ways, a myriad of ways, the issue of sexuality affects the world. And also in the context of the ancient Greek and Roman world, which is my area of research, and about which I'd say, you know, I see a lot of similarity between our world and that world, and the idea that we are now so modern, we do this as if this modern world had never existed before. I would very seriously challenge that, but that's a very prevalent thought. Here we are, we're now modern, this is what we do, and I would say, go back 2,000 years, and you'll find many of the same kind of influences and impacts affecting the ancient world through the Greeks and the Romans, and the small group of Hebrews and Christians with a very minority morality in the midst of this massive world. So why were we talking about this? Well, we saw that about one-third of the overtures and the recommendations coming before our General Assembly are on issues of ordination, especially in relationship to sexual orientation and to faithfulness or lack thereof in marriage, and also the issue of the definition of marriage is coming up at the General Assembly. There are references in our Book of Order, which is part of our Constitution, especially in the section on worship, which refers to marriage quite explicitly as a covenant between a man and a woman. That's our present definition. And there are a number of overtures that would omit the words man and woman and replace them with two persons or two people. So there would be effectively a change in the definition or just an ignoring of a definition of marriage there. And then there are some overtures relating to the permissibility of a pastor and a church to be involved in a ceremony, which is the blessing of a gay couple or a gay marriage, especially in states where that is legal. So the question is, in a state where it's legal, can a pastor, if asked to officiate at that Presbyterian pastor, officiate there, and can you use the church facility for such a ceremony? So that's, and there's more to it. There's other issues of property that relate to this, and later on, Quinn and or I will speak a little bit about folks not wanting to be in particular presbyteries, which are very affirming or not affirming of the ordination of self-affirming practicing homosexual persons. I say that whole thing, self-affirming practicing homosexual persons, because the church has always ordained homosexual persons. It's not the orientation which is at stake here. It's the practice. It's what you do with it which is the issue. So, and the same is true of heterosexuality. It's not the orientation. It's what you do with it. So chastity in singleness or faithfulness in the covenant of marriage between a man and a woman was the old wording which has been removed from our Book of Order. So these issues are still coming to our General Assembly, about a third of the business. And so I spoke last time about the biblical, my biblical and confessional view of marriage. But I said in summary was this, that in the Bible I understand marriage to be a covenant between one man and one woman, actually a lifelong covenant. If you read the confessions of our faith, so that our Book of Order and our Book of Confessions constitute our constitution, I believe you cannot escape the fact that this is the norm there. So it's our heritage, but it's also, I believe, biblically true. For me, the first three chapters of Genesis are critical. People say, well, I can't believe Genesis these days, and I answer, actually, my belief in the importance of Genesis 1 to 3 has got nothing to do whether it's historical or not. It, in C.S. Lewis terms, even if it's what the classicists would call a myth, and you've got to be careful with that, he would say it's the true myth, which means it's the story which tells us who we are. So that, for me, is more important than can you prove things actually happened in this way or that. So that from an authoritative point of view, it is the story which tells us who we are, and critical to that story is one man, one woman, forever, one flesh. That's huge, and Jesus repeats that, and the Apostle Paul repeats that. They go back there. I want to be technical, the Germans call this Urzeit Endzeit. As in the beginning, so in the end. So you go back to the beginning to find out how it should end. And Jesus picks up on that. Of course, in Genesis 1 through 3, we also learn that we are all sinners. So that's where we learn that we have all fallen short of the glory of God, because what Adam and Eve do is what we do. And so you've got both the standard and the fact that we are fallen, and much more in there. But that's where my understanding of marriage comes from, and I see it affirmed by Jesus and by the Apostle Paul in the early church. One other little bit there in terms of the New Testament, there's actually very little said about homosexuality. There are a couple of places. The biggest issues that are raised are divorce. Jesus speaks very strongly about divorce, and yet we make exceptions. The most common issue in the New Testament relating to sexuality is the use of the word porneia, from which we get pornography. And it just means sexual irregularity. But generally, it's translated fornication, and the issue very clearly at stake is sex outside the covenant of marriage. And that's frequent as something that you don't do. So those are the general biblical principles. That's the ideal. What about the reality? Back to Genesis 3, we're all Plan B people. And in any discussion, we've got to acknowledge that. Otherwise, we wouldn't need a Savior. So in some parts of our life, some people, it's obvious. Some, it's not so obvious. But for every one of us, whatever's going on in our life, it needed the Son of God to die for. So it's serious in every single one of us. And nobody escapes from that. And that is critical in all of our discussion to acknowledge that.
Nobody escapes
being a Plan B person. We all have sin in our lives, which is serious enough to require the Son of God to die for us. So while I may say I've led a morally wonderful life, aren't you glad you call me as your minister? What I need you to know, and what my wife, it's a good thing she's not here, could tell you. Oh, she's just walking in. Even as I speak. It's sort of like Ananias and Sapphira. But I would tell you, you know, David needs a Savior too. You better believe it. The point is, whether it's obvious, whether sins are obvious or not, every one of us is a sinner who needs the grace of God in Jesus Christ and requires the death of the Son of God for us to be saved. So all I'm saying is that no matter, whenever we're talking in this case about people who don't meet a certain standard, we don't meet the standard at some point or another. And we've got to remember that. And not all Christian conversation about this issue seems to have remembered that. And then I mentioned already the Greek world and Roman world in which the gospel came, and the fact that we all make exceptions. So in the Bible in different places. So it's not an easy thing to interpret. Even though the Bible says homosexual practice is wrong, it also says, and Jesus says explicitly, divorce is wrong, but we say, but what about this? So even in the case of homosexuality, it surely is legitimate to say, but what about this? And we do it at some point or another. So our job as Christians is to blend the ideal and the exceptions. And how do we do that? And there's no easy answer. How do we maintain standards while being gracious? And all I answer at that is we need a lot of prayer and we need God's wisdom. And different churches are probably going to come out on different sides of that issue. If you were to ask me, if somebody would say, but this is a threat against Christian moral standards, I actually would argue that the most serious sexual threat out there to the overarching Christian ethos is not homosexuality or at least faithful homosexual relationships, but promiscuity in general, which is far more rampant among heterosexuals than it is amongst homosexual persons. And so, because we are Reformed Christians for whom the covenant, God's covenant with us and our covenant with God is critical, that is, we live because of the promises of God and we respond to the promises of God by making promises to God and to one another, this is foundational to our Reformed understanding of what it is to be a Christian. The loss of promise, the loss of covenant in society is to change society completely. You don't know where you stand with people. And I happen to believe the happiness of any society is very closely linked to the knowledge that you know where you stand with your neighbor. Lose that, then all of life becomes litigious and begins to degenerate. So is it serious? Yes. But are there other serious things out there? Yes. So that leads us to cohabitation. It's rampant. It's multiplied. Interestingly, just looking around, one of the folks with us last week showed me an article from New York Times last week, backing up evidence which has been mounting, but it's in the New York Times last week, about the dangers of cohabitation. That if you think that helps you to enter a marriage later, all the evidence is it doesn't. So if you've got children, grandchildren saying, I need to try this out first, you can never escape the try it out mode. Once you've begun with the thought of trying it out, you can never move quite beyond, not never, but it's very hard to move beyond that. So that's where we were last time, and I'll see if I can get my stuff up here. So that's the background last time. Let's move on, and what I'm going to do, this is probably going to be fairly boring stuff. We're going to go through this spreadsheet here to see what else is coming up at the General Assembly. What you have actually on your sheet, and I'll just look at this. First of all, I put an X beside things actually really just to help me sort them out. So that X doesn't mean anything except to get to the top. All the issues relating to sexuality. There's some property issues. There are polity issues, how our presbyteries are organized. We'll come back to that later. There are ordination issues. You turn over the page, and you see marriage issues. So do you see? Actually, I've got 5 pages, so that's almost 2/5 of the General Assembly stuff relates to these issues. Then you've got all the other issues. I'm going to ask Quinn to speak in a little while about the theology issues, Confession of Belhar, Heidelberg Catechism, then over to page 3. So what's coming up at General Assembly? A ton of all kinds of little issues. A new Presbyterian hymnal has been prepared and will be published in 2013. So if you think there's only controversy about sexuality, I'll tell you what, introducing a new hymnal to a church creates even more dissension. In the church I came from in Spartanburg, when the new hymnal was introduced in, 1989 or something like that, there was virtual war there. So their decision in the south, you've got a red hymnal, the red hymnal and our blue hymnal. Couldn't decide what to do. So what they did was expand the size of the pew racks for hymns, for hymnals. So they have both hymnals. So any Sunday morning, we're singing from the red hymnal this morning, the blue hymnal, rather than get rid of one, which actually worked. But you know, your choice of hymns, what's in there. I checked out the list. You can go online, by the way, and it's on, let me see, where is it? PCbiz.org. Is it in here somewhere? Yeah. You just beat me to that. Okay, it's on the front page of the first thing. This week, everything else, PCbiz.org. If you want to see the details of any of these overtures, that's where you go. But you can see the list of all the hymns in there. And as Ed asked, the crucial question, you know what the crucial question of the new hymnal is? Is Onward Christian Soldiers in there? The answer is no, it's not. So, but anyway, that's the list is there. So that's coming out in 2013. I thought a resolution to recommit to celebrate the decade of hearing and singing new songs to God was worship, but actually, it's really about women's ministry in the church and doesn't have anything to do with worship. I'm the one, by the way, who filled the column in on the right-hand side just to help me sort through these things. Some of the issues are relating to support. And at this I will pick up right here. And actually go down this list here and you can see what I'm looking at. Just the support of the denomination. So some financial things, encouragement of church to think about wills and bequests. There's a place where churches invest their money. There's a significant ministry among Native Americans, and one group would like us to have a 3-year nationwide offering for Native Americans. We have special offerings. We've just received the One Great Hour of Sharing offering. That's OGHS for emergencies. Some churches take up an offering called the Christmas Joy offering for retired Presbyterian ministers and for our colleges at what we call our racial ethnic colleges. Pentecost is usually for youth, and World Communion offering is a new offering to replace the peacemaking offering. Safe child policy to ensure that churches are implementing this. In my 9 months here, you need to know that our building is not a good building for children and for safety. You need, for a building to be safe, you need any place where children go to be in clear proximity to other places where people are. And you need big windows and doors. And we've got some work to do to make our place safe that way. So this is something I hope we will work on. And it's just very important that we keep working on that. There's some issues relating to poverty, and our friends up in Baltimore are saying that their poverty zone development area is actually only creating low-wage jobs and not much employment. They want us to do something about that. There are motions calling for the end of practice of corporal punishment in homes. Let me just get back up to that. homes, schools, and childcare facilities, undertaking a parenting initiative called Institute for Effective Parental Leadership. This is actually really also about especially helping poorer families with parenting skills. It's a huge issue with poorer families in terms of just basic skills, and apparently this is an excellent course. Good question. Let me go back. These are overtures. Sorry for not explaining. Overtures from different presbyteries coming to the General Assembly, asking the General Assembly to act. Generally speaking, requiring churches either to study something or to do something in response to these requests. They go to a committee through a committee system, rather like our government, and they may be rejected, or an affirmation to turn them down, or changed in some way before they come to the full floor of the General Assembly. But there are a ton of them, and some of them will escape from the General Assembly and come down our way.
So.
Yes. Of course, the question for a lot of these is, so they make a rule about this and what happens next? And much of the time, the answer is zero. So there's a... if we go back to my talk 2 weeks ago, and I'm sorry, should have really started here, is I believe that much of this process is completely ineffective. I'm sorry. I should have given my cynical spin on this very early on, that some of this is good to be paying attention to. No doubt, I mean, I think we should think about these things, and I certainly think we should be thinking and making sure our buildings are safe for kids. So there's some good things along the way, but there's a ton of stuff which you go, so what, and what's going on that drives this? Now, clearly, the issue of corporal punishment is an issue we should think about, but the idea that in a church everybody would agree on that, that's not going to happen there. I haven't read the details of this, whether it's in the context of abuse. It may well be. We'll see. Let me keep on going. So these are from different parts of the country. They're coming to the General Assembly. They will be assigned to a committee which will discuss them, choose to recommend to approve them, reject them, or they may amend them in some way to send them to the plenary session. Some of them are about the Book of Order. What about this? To eliminate the list of those whom we refuse to discriminate against. This, over the last 20 years, lists have been increasingly long about, well, we don't want to discriminate against this person or that person, and this presbytery is saying, scrap that, start again, just say we need to treat people well. Rather than be explicit. Healthcare. So this is an overture from Mid-Kentucky, and basically saying, I wonder what the idea is in our room here, that we should all be in favor of a single payment health insurance program run by the government. So they're saying that we should check into companies to see if they are promoting this or not. I think there'll be a nice little debate on that. Recognizing Bloomfield College as a racial ethnic college. This is a college in New Jersey which has a very wide diversity of its student population. If it becomes an assigned racial ethnic college, there's an opportunity for funding and support there. Strengthening connections with racial ethnic churches. Should we have more connections with churches different from ours? Yes. Endorsing a 50-year farm bill. That's actually about the environment. It's not a very good title, supporting the environment. Instructing the General Assembly to implement PCUSA's policy of inclusion of people with disabilities. So can you make all churches do this? But actually, once again, is our building, our facility, a welcoming place for people with disabilities? No, it is not. You've got to really know a lot to find the elevator. And I mean, and is it close to where you walk in the door? Can you get to where you want quickly? No, you cannot. There's steps everywhere and so forth. And should we be thinking about that? Yes. Are there easy solutions? No. But we should be thinking, what's it like to walk into our facility? But can you make people do this? Nah. Directing the Board of Pensions not to pay for abortions except to save the life of the woman. This is our Presbyterian medical insurance company that ordained pastors are on. So that's an issue. Reevaluating the process which ordination exams are written. I'm sure you're all excited about that. Amend the setting of the service of ordination installation of teaching elders so that it's not on a Sunday morning. So the idea here is that if it's on a Sunday morning, then ministers in other churches cannot come. And ordination of ministers is not an act of the church, it's of the presbytery, so it should be in the afternoon. And mine was. I expected hundreds of ministers to come. I didn't actually expect that. But add special consideration for membership for family. You're getting the point here. For families serving yoked churches. So my wife and I served a church, four churches that were yoked together. If she wanted to, if this passed, she could be a member of all four churches. I don't know how big the debate will be on this, but I'm just going to keep going. Report of the Special Committee of Existing Authoritative Interpretations. This is a classic case of the business of the church creates more business. So we changed our constitution and approved that, and then we have a whole listing of ways to interpret the old constitution, which are now outdated, and which now have to be updated to reflect the new constitution. Well, so, then in the new constitution, ministers are no longer called ministers of word and sacrament, but teaching elders. I kind of like that, actually. But I also like to be a minister of word and sacrament. Our lay elders are ruling elders. Well, here's an amendment to say we don't like that, so let's change it back. And my reason for voting against this is I can't tell you how many committee hours I've spent this year in a committee changing our own operating procedures to include the new language for ministers. So if they change it back, I think I'll die. I think I see Emmy back there for this. Yes, Bruce. I'm really trying to get to the exciting stuff. I'm actually doing this on purpose. I really am. I thought I'm just going to do this just so you get this feel a lot. There are going to be hundreds of people who are going to be looking at this stuff and work their way through it. Now, some of it is, I'm being a little facetious, I know, but let me see what I can find here. I'm not sure that I can tell you much about that. Nominations from the floor. I mean, basically, this is about, if you make nominations from the floor at the General Assembly, you've got to give the delegates enough time to think about it, so otherwise they won't vote wisely there. So this is taking up a whole lot of time of hundreds of people. So here's one about inclusivity, which does mandate in the Book of Order that we should ensure participation of all kinds of people. And here's a discussion of, actually, let's not ensure it, but let's strive for it there. So I'm just keeping on going. Investigating committee, dealing with abuse from ministers. And this is actually important that you do know, given all the abuse in different churches by priests and pastors and so forth, that our presbytery has a pretty strong policy on that. And nationally, we want that too. So here's something which is It's pretty important that you know that we have a process there in our church. If you work with a church of a different denomination, how do you resolve issues? So there are many churches working with different denominations. That's what that's about. Committee to review biennial assemblies. Report to the 220th General Assembly. Now, this is something of real substance because the recommendations are, I say because, they in fact relate in some ways to an overture. They didn't read my overture that I sent 2 years ago with some friends down in South Carolina to the General Assembly saying, our General Assembly is broken in many ways. The way we just do business creates conflict, and it leads us to focus on the wrong things. So sometimes we focus on the right things, but we spend hours and hours at the General Assembly just going through nothing much at all. This committee basically says, no, we're not going back to a General Assembly every year. We're going to keep it at every 2 years. But what they're saying is that overtures, that's all these things, can only come to the General Assembly if, before they go to the General Assembly, they have the support of 10% of the presbyteries. Okay, so if you think that some of this is trivial, a lot of them, what they're saying is that's the same thing. We want to cut this down. You've got to really work hard to see if other presbyteries support you before you get this to the General Assembly. I think that may be a little stiff. But at least 5%, or at least say you need 10 presbyteries before you can get it up there. So that's one of the things. They want to turn the General Assembly into more of a worship atmosphere or focusing on a theological theme. And I think generally it's a good move. But nevertheless, this is not about the world. It's about how we conduct our business. So it's not about creating churches. It's not about preaching the gospel, building hospitals. It's about how do we run things. And we're in this circle in which we delve deeper and deeper into how we run things. Celebrating an anniversary of the church in Cuba. Many of you don't know there's a Presbyterian church in Cuba. I've been there 3 times, and there are some wonderful Christians in that beleaguered land who need our support. They approved the Presbyterian Women's Bible Study, which is going to be a highly political Bible study in the coming year on Palestinian Christians. We're now into justice issues. These may be more interesting. There are a number on immigration, if you look at your list, on immigration issues. One from Arizona basically saying that the laws in Arizona went too far. The General Assembly basically made a motion which boycotted Arizona, and clearly the Presbyterians in Arizona are not too pleased with that. So they're basically saying pull back. But there are some other ones about immigration and saying we should be involved in talking about that, and I think as Christians, how we do that in the church, I don't know. But should we be thinking about this? Of course we should. Here's one which raises the whole issue about what about those immigrant children who were brought to this country as infants and so forth, have no standing in the country, and they're caught in the middle of all of what's going on here. What should we do with those children? So it focuses on the children. Once again, back to Mike's question, if the General Assembly says this is how we ought to do things, the fact remains that just as our denomination is split 50-50 on the ordination issue relating to homosexuals, we're half Democrat, we're half Republican, we're half this, we're half that. There's no way that this is going to be implemented all over the place. But should we be thinking about these things, and should we be asking where does Jesus fit into these issues? Yes. I'm almost through. I think I've missed. Have I missed Israel, Palestine in this? I just skipped. That was probably intentional. Have I just missed it again? Justice, Israel, Palestine. Okay, lots of things relating to Israel and Palestine. So this has been a major debate in the General Assembly was last year. It's taking different views this time. And this is a very important issue. Many folks do not know that there's a significant number of Palestinian Christians who get lost in the shuffle between Palestinian Muslims and the Israelis, between them and the Jews. And they're actually leaving the Middle East in large numbers, so it's a shrinking community. But one of the main places where they have been prominent is actually Bethlehem. And so the question of where do the Palestinians fit in is not just an Israel-Palestine terrorist democratic nation thing. There are issues relating to Christians on the ground who are just having a really hard struggle because of all these international issues and are very much alone and need support. Not all of these are about that. Here's one which basically says Israel's laws are amounting to apartheid, and we need to do something about that. Boycotting a Harvard Dead Sea Laboratories and Hadiklaim, which grows dates. Actually, I was in Israel a year ago. Shouldn't really say this. I bought a bunch of Ahava stuff, which is makeup stuff for all the administrative assistants in my church in Spartanburg. We changed planes in Vienna, and they confiscated it all. It was carry-on, and each of the tubes was just too big to carry on, so we had to throw out $150 worth of... So, I'm sorry just for sharing that. But then divestment. This is a big issue from Caterpillar, because Caterpillar builds equipment which can be used to bulldoze down Palestinian homes. It certainly can. That same equipment, by the way, was actually used to bulldoze down settler homes in Gaza at one point as well, so it goes both ways. So there are issues relating to that. I know that this has been pretty sterile stuff. Just want you to know the kind of stuff that's occurring there. Some of these things are interesting. We could go into more detail at time, but here was basically an overview. What I'd like to ask Quinn to do is to share with us two things. One is all the way back to the theology issues, which have to do with our Book of Confessions. And then Quinn knows a whole lot more about what is the controversy stirred up? What has been stirred up in the denomination because of all the questions on sexuality? People are leaving, people are staying, people are doing this and that. What's happening in a broader context there, outside of General Assembly as well as inside, relating to our denomination there? So, Quinn, thank you.
I have a little handout. It's the tiny handout. Associate pastors get to do half sheets, and we only get one side.
Two sides if this is good.
Okay. Actually, I didn't have that much. Let me say, I had a conversation with a former colleague in the Office of Theology and Worship, and he said that assignments for the Office of Theology and Worship of all these various overtures, and there are always dozens and dozens, it's 50% fewer this year. So for as many of these overtures as there are a lot less than there often are, which ought to really boggle our minds. And he said the majority of them are about the issue of the marriage and sexuality or of the Israeli-Palestine situation. And so that's the preoccupation. But there are two overtures that involve theology and involve our Book of Confessions. We have two parts of the Constitution in addition to the Bible, which is an understood foundation. One of them is the Book of Confessions. The other is the Book of Order. In order to change the Book of Order, it can be changed really every time the General Assembly meets. If you've seen up here the language of amend, if it says amend, they're saying that they should amend the Book of Order. And it just takes the Assembly to approve it, and for half the presbyteries, a simple majority to approve it. And as soon as that's done, it goes into effect. If you're going to change the theology of the church, it's a six-year process, and it takes a supermajority three-quarter vote. And that's to change the Book of Confessions. And that's the way that it should be. If we change, you know, the rules very frequently. And people will say, well, maybe it ought not to be so easy. But it certainly ought to be more difficult to change your theological standards. 4 years ago, an overture came saying there are some inaccuracies in the translation of the Heidelberg Catechism, one of our beloved catechisms, in the English. And you compare it to the German, and there are errors, and we're pointing out five, and we want you to change them. And there was actually an ideological agenda for which five they picked, but it became moot because they got a special task force together. A good friend of mine read through the original text in Greek, or excuse me, in German and Latin of the Heidelberg Catechism, and he said, you know what? There's a whole lot more than five problems here. The net result is they found out that the Christian Reformed Church, as well as the Reformed Church of America, were busy at work to completely revise the translation of the Heidelberg Catechism, and they said, can we join you in this? And those two denominations said yes, and so at this General Assembly, an entirely brand new translation, a better translation, a much more accurate translation, and more theologically sound translation, that actually gives some clarity to some statements about Christology and things that Orthodox theological folks like David and me are happy about, will come before the Assembly for recommendation. And if the Assembly approves it, it will go to the presbyteries. And if three-quarters of the presbyteries approve of inserting the new translation, it will go into the Book of Order and substitute for the Heidelberg Catechism. This is a major thing. It's taken a long time. In some ways, I think that there's been a broad coalition of people who have been on the task force from conservative to progressive in their theological orientation. They're all 100% behind it. So my prediction is that the Assembly will approve it and that the presbyteries will approve it, and that in 2 years we'll have an updated version of the Heidelberg Catechism in the Book of Confessions. The same process began 2 years prior to Heidelberg with a confession from South Africa called Belhar. You may remember some conversations here. Junior McGarahan was actually pretty involved in that. It did not receive a supermajority vote in the presbyteries this past year, and so it failed to and it will not be added to the Book of Confession. But that this General Assembly, the National Capital Presbytery, has proposed that they restart the process. And so it'll be interesting to see if anyone has any energy to try to get this started again. But if they do, it will be, again, a six-year process to reintroduce that. And, again, you cannot change it every time the General Assembly meets like you can the Book of Order. Do we want to do a quick question, Chuck? Any session can propose an overture. They bring it before the presbytery meeting, and the presbytery debates it, and it's a simple majority of whether or not it is approved. And so that happened in this presbytery two or three meetings ago, and they approved it, and so it's going forward. There is an entire committee dedicated to the confessions, and so they will mainly spend their time examining the accuracy. Not that there'll be any experts there, but they will have expert people to give testimony on the retranslation of Heidelberg. It's interesting. I mean, we're asking garden variety Presbyterians, pastors with some basic Greek and Hebrew, to come together and make decisions about the translation of 16th century German and Latin. Most are not able to do that, and so, but nonetheless, those are the kinds of decisions that our General Assembly is asked to make. Fortunately, like I said, it's a six-year process. So that's what's happening in theology, and oftentimes there's a lot more theology, theological issues, but there's really not very much this time. And then there's the question of polity, property. Well, let me just say that everyone in the church realizes that the church is changing because the culture is changing. And it's more difficult to be the church now than probably at any other time in our lives, at least in this country. And whether you're a progressive or a conservative, regardless of what you are concerned about in terms of your issues, you realize there's got to be some changes. And so the Fellowship of Presbyterians, which we've talked about, and the Evangelical Covenant Order, or ECO, which is part of the movement of the Fellowship of Presbyterians, are saying there need to be some changes. But the last General Assembly said there need to be some changes, and they appointed a commission, which actually has a lot more authority and ability than a simple task force, to study the way that we're governed. Now, you remember that the way that we're, maybe you don't remember, the way that we're structured and that we're governed, that there are churches that have sessions, and all of the churches belong to a presbytery. We belong to National Capital Presbytery. There are 171 or 173 presbyteries in the PCUSA. And they all send commissioners to the General Assembly. But there is another middle governing function called a synod, and there are 16 synods, and we're part of the Synod of the Mid-Atlantic or Middle Atlantic. And where I was in Colorado, it was the Synod of the Rocky Mountains. And so there are 16 of these, and they're geographical. And the middle governing bodies commission, and they changed the Book of Orders, and now it's the Mid-Councils Commission, because they don't use the word governing bodies anymore. So they changed the name of the group in the midst of it, have been together for 2 years, and they have talked to a wide variety of people, and they're coming with recommendations to the assembly. And one of the major recommendations, because they say, we are not nearly light enough on our feet, and there's all kinds of just cumbersome processes, and they're expensive, too. And who wants to spend money on some of these outmoded forms of doing business? And the net of it is that they're basically saying, we should get rid of synods. Not completely. We need for the judicial appeal process, when there is some kind of a church court case, we need to have synod judicial commissions to hear appeals from presbyteries, as a kind of a filter. I don't know what would be the equivalent in the U.S., but you don't want to go from the circuit court all the way to the Supreme Court. You got to have something in the middle, and I'm sure there's an attorney here who can tell me what the courts in between are. But that the Synod Permanent Judicial Commission is the one thing that they want to keep. And then if enough of the presbyteries in a particular geographic synod decide they want something, to do something together, say a camp or a retreat center, then they're allowed to do that. But for the most part, they're saying, let's do away with almost everything that has to do with synods. And it will be really interesting to see how the commissioners to this assembly react to it, because they have to approve that recommendation or not. Furthermore, there seems to be a lot of interest in recommending the possibility of non-geographic presbyteries, that is, congregations not being bound within the geographical realm of churches, but perhaps affiliating with another collection of churches. But they're putting some caveats on there, not just because you don't like living next door to some of these other congregations or because you don't necessarily get along, although that might be an ulterior kind of motive or reason why you would petition out of it. But if you have a particular ministry or orientation in the mission of your congregation that would fit better, if you're on the boundary of a rural presbytery, but you're an inner city church, say in Newark, New Jersey, and I don't even know how the presbytery structures are there, you might say, we would rather be part of New York City Presbytery because they're all urban downtown churches and they're doing the same kinds of things that we are. And most of our Presbyterian meetings are about rural concerns and smaller churches. And so it would be that kind of a decision. This will be a very controversial discussion. Whether or not how can we not do the things the way we've always done them. But the point is that even within the cumbersome structures of the General Assembly, we Presbyterians are saying we've got to do some things differently. We've got to figure out some different ways of doing this. There are two overtures that will not gain any traction to allow property ownership by individual congregations rather than presbyteries, and there are always things like this, and this is just the wrong time and place to have the conversation and the discussion, and so you know that's mentioned, but there won't be much of that. And then the last thing to talk about is really not so much a part of the General Assembly business, but you want to talk about ECO and the fellowship? And you've got a handout about that. The Evangelical Covenant Order. Let me give you a little bit of a history lesson, and I did not put together a PowerPoint presentation. I can actually put together a packet for those who would be interested. I wasn't certain that we were going to go in this direction. The Evangelical Covenant Order is actually a new alternative denomination. And it is the latest attempt, the latest solution to longstanding disagreements that are deeply theologically rooted, but also are manifest in terms of our understanding of human sexuality, the covenant of marriage, and ordination standards. And the Evangelical Covenant Order is an attempt to differentiate among certain congregations whose pastors have not, and whose congregations have not, up to this point, wanted to leave. All along the road, since 1973 when the PCA was formed, in 1981 when the Evangelical Presbyterian Church has formed, there have been Presbyterians leaving the PCUSA, or the old PCUS and the old UPCUSA in the north, to go to these more conservative denominations. The PCA does not ordain women, and they only use the Westminster Confession for their confession of faith. The Evangelical Presbyterian Church has local option on the ordination of women, and they are a little bit lighter on their feet theologically, or not quite so strictly adherent to the Westminster standards, or at least in their interpretation of them. They do use the Westminster Confession. There have been options and places to go for evangelicals and conservatives within the Presbyterian denomination. And most of them that were going to go went. But about a year and a half ago, a group of evangelicals who are committed to staying, or were committed to staying within the PCUSA, got together and said, we've got to do something. And they formed a group called the Fellowship of Presbyterians. And they basically, in my interpretation, they were looking for ways to stay. How can we stay within the denomination that is going to throw out the language that specifically says chastity in singleness, fidelity within marriage, a man and a woman? When that is gone, how do we stay? And they said, well, we ought to rethink the whole thing. And they said, first of all, we want to be focused on growth. We want to be focused on mission. We want to be focused on Jesus Christ. And we want to quit fighting about all this stuff that we're fighting about that are really not essential to the gospel. Important morally as they are, we want to move beyond it. And so we're going to form a fellowship, and we're going to have some standards, and we're going to form a covenant that we agree to. And they have a 5 or 6 point covenant that not everyone in the denomination would want to sign on to, because it basically says we're going to take seriously the mission of Jesus Christ. We're going to take seriously the Bible, theology, social justice, commitment to the environment. I mean, it's a broad shalom kind of vision, and we're going to be committed to these. And this is not for everybody to do, but we, the Fellowship of Presbyterians, are going to do something differently. And so they began that in 2010, moving into 2011. And they invited many to join them. And I don't know how many. There were over 2,000 last August in Minneapolis, and again, more than 2,000 in Orlando back in January. Presbyterians representing some 800 congregations who were looking to do things differently, but who had not chosen to leave up to this point. Along the way, they realized that there were some congregations who just were so upset with the changes that they had seen in the PCUSA That whether the pastors wanted to or not, or whether, you know, everybody in the congregation wanted to or not, that they needed to get some distance in terms of their polity. And so they created a new denomination, which is the Evangelical Covenant Order of Presbyterians. They hold to pretty much the same theological and covenant commitments that the Fellowship of Presbyterians holds to. They want to be about something different. They want to, one of the things that they've added is a 10-step narrative of the health of a congregation. Questions that every congregation needs to ask itself every year, and that congregations used to, up until about 1930 or 40, regularly ask themselves. Accountability questions. What has the Holy Spirit been doing among us? And how do we measure it in terms of conversions, in terms of baptisms, in terms of membership growth? And measurable criteria that they want to mutually be held accountable to. And so the Fellowship of Presbyterians and the Evangelical Covenant Order are all committed to these things. The Evangelical Covenant Order is those congregations who simply said it is just not going to work for us to stay connected in terms of polity to the PCUSA for whatever reason. There are some congregations that are really alone and are being uncharitably treated by their presbyteries. I mean, life is being made miserable for them. And it's unconscionable and it's awful, but there's nothing you can do about it unless you're in that presbytery. And I can see, boy, they need to leave. And then there are others for different reasons who are deciding to do it. The church where I became a Presbyterian in First Colorado Springs voted on Sunday to join that. And so there is this move that is outside of what's happening in General Assembly, but it's of interest to many I know in this room. And then we're at time.
What other large churches did Orlando?
Orlando was going to go to the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, and I haven't followed up on it, but I heard that the EPC basically got back to them, maybe this is incorrect, and said, we don't think your reasons are good enough to come and join us. So I don't know where Orlando... Yeah, which was an interesting...
These are 3,000 to 5,000 member churches.
Yeah, Colorado Springs is 4,200. They are the first large church. There are 7 or 8 other pretty healthy churches in the Presbytery of Pueblo, which is southern Colorado, that will inevitably follow Colorado Springs into the Evangelical Covenant Order. Okay, so
do we have choir tonight? Choir members? No choir.
Okay.
We can go until 9 or 10.
All right. Yeah.
So what we're actually going to do is take a break. If anybody does need to leave, we'll stand up, stretch. If you need to leave, please feel free to do what you need to do. And we'll gather for another 10 or 15 minutes after that.